So, you know, when I was thinking about introducing you, Paul, I was just trying to think, what am I going to say? Because, you know, I've introduced you before, and I've known you for, you know, 20-plus years, and, you know, so what do I say that's fresh and new? And I was sitting here thinking, and, you know, what do I say about Dr. Paul Herskew? And what came to my mind is that the depth of your genius is not immediately obvious. And what I mean by that is that for those of you who know Paul or who are familiar with somewhat with his work, there's just a depth of understanding and a depth of insight in Paul's work relative to homeopathy that you simply just don't find anyplace else. And unfortunately, because most of us don't have the level of brilliance and intelligence that Paul has, we have difficulty seeing how brilliant and how insightful his model has really taken homeopathy to a whole new level. So I think more than anything, Paul, I just want to acknowledge the tremendous contribution you've made to homeopathy through the cycles and segments model, because I really see it as a way to take this universal principle of medicine, of healing, and allow it to become systematic and duplicatable. And I think for that, I mean, I think you're going to go down in the history books as one of the people who've really made the greatest contributions to homeopathy. So I want to personally thank you, and if anybody ever has an opportunity to study with Paul or, you know, apprentice with him, I can't recommend it highly enough. Paul is just simply one of the most gifted practitioners and educators that we have in our community. So personally, thank you very much.
Well, that was incredibly embarrassing.
Paul, so are you do before we start, are you is there anything that you're offering or you want to let people know about, any seminars or conferences or?
Well, there's, you know, on topic for weekend is I'm doing a conference in Florida, but that's sort of booked up, so I'm not really advertising that.
Okay, but what about Portland? You're starting a new class?
I'm going to start one in January for, and it's going to run for a year and a half in the Portland, Oregon venue.
Okay, and if
It's a
people just
nature
want to get
conference,
more
so.
information about where they can study with you or about your classes or the school or your journals or anything like that, where would they get that information from?
Nesh, www.nesh.com.
Okay.
Okay, let's get started.
Okay. Well, maybe a little bit later on, you can tell us a little bit about the Herskew letter, because I think that's something that might be of
Okay.
interest to people.
Okay.
So, Paul, you had suggested that we talk a little bit about homeopathy and its relationship to treating animals, and I just thought maybe on a personal side, what's your first memory of actually working with veterinarians using homeopathy?
Well, the boy, this probably takes me back to working in Omaha, where besides treating lots of children, we were constantly going to different farms and so on, and mostly meeting vets who were working with larger animals, mostly cows, actually. And just working with the vets, trying to keep the cows healthy, trying to minimize antibiotic use, trying to keep them productive, and at the same time, kind of noticing the relationship of the remedies that we were giving to the how they present in people. So I'd say it's been a, I don't know, 20-something year adventure working with vets, working with animals. But you know, primarily, I have always been the naturalist. Primarily, that's the thing that brought me to medicine in the first place. That's been my biggest interest, as any of my kids will tell you, when we go hiking in the woods, but just turning over every rock and every piece of wood. So yeah, it's been a long interest of mine, and I've often taught vets in my classes and worked with, you know, a certain percent of the students that I will have let's say 5-10% in any class would wind up being vets.
So, Paul, I mean, I know that lately you've been doing a lot of work with veterinarians who work with animals, and people mostly know you as somebody who wrote, you know, the Home Traffic Treatment of Children, and as somebody who has for years now worked educating other people to actually become proficient practitioners. So why are you focusing now on working with animals? What's going on with all of this?
You know, the thing is, the children were one example or one part of a larger issue that I saw looming, a larger issue that I've seen be a problem in our profession, which is that there's been a lot of teaching, there's been a lot of books written on, there's been a lot of different stuff in homeopathy, and yet few of it really often relates to what practice looks like, to what a child really looks like in the office. And so my first kind of thrown into it, my first endeavors involved the writing and treatment of children, and which is still, you know, by far my largest interest. In fact, this weekend my next book comes out on children.
And what's the title of that one?
In that one, it's actually a non-homeopathic book.
Oh, that's right. You told me about it.
It's about education with children, just how to help children with learning disabilities, basically overcome them in a very systematic way. But anyway, that's on the besides that. What I noticed in working with children and then teaching my work around the world has been that there is a fair amount of people that have a sense that they know what a remedy looks like because they read it in a certain way, and then when we talk about it, they just see it in a totally different light, and all of a sudden they learn how to prescribe it, how to actually recognize it in the clinic. It kind of busts open their practice, and all these remedies that they had studied and so on, all of a sudden makes sense, and they can see it in the children in front of them. And what's interesting to me is going to a new country and seeing that develop within a, you know, basically two conferences. Conference number one, going to a new country, talking about, let's say, the hyoscyamus and veratrumin, Mansonella, and remedies like that, and people saying, oh, there's no such thing as these kinds of remedies in this country, and then coming back and then saying, oh, my God, we saw these remedies. It was just like the way you described them. We just had this impression that was just different, so on and so forth. Anyway, nowhere else in homeopathy do we see it in a similar way as in the veterinary medical homeopathic world, where there is a certain sense of homeopathy. There's a sort of discussion of what classical homeopathy is, and then there's a sort of a disconnect between that and what the practice really comes across. And so it's been a big interest of mine all the way along to try to shift that, try to help that move in a certain way. So that's one interest of mine. A second interest of mine in terms of working in with animals is sort of a proof of principle concept, which is if you can do something with an animal that doesn't actually speak English, doesn't actually speak a spoken language that is similar to ours, and you get to the remedy in a similar fashion that you would with an unconscious person, with a baby, with a one-day-old baby, with a one-year-old kid, with a five-year-old kid, with a 90-year-old person who's unconscious, it kind of proves the sort of universal principles that underpin homeopathy. So that's yet a second reason. Third reason is that it's much easier to do animal models and animal studies in a controlled fashion that you can't actually do with people.
Hmm.
And you can actually do blinded studies that are easier, that you can also, you can control genetics in a way that you can't control with people.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of, and so much of what we do is, from my point of view, very reproducible and very, you know, you can test it, you can demonstrate it and so on, and yet our heritage, our homeopathic heritage, has not had a lot of success in that, in those studies. So it's been interesting for me to try to help bridge some of these divides, get rid of some of this sort of cognitive dissonances that exist in our profession.
Now, I guess there's one difference in the veterinary community, Paul, in that there aren't really formal provings done on animals. Do you see that as an issue, or?
Not at all. There aren't any formal provings done on babies.
Mm, that's true, huh? That's right.
On 5-year-olds, on 2-year-olds, on, you know, it's not already legal to do a proving under, you know, in an underage person.
Sure, sure.
So that's, and you know, there are so many questions on why it's different. But the truth is, it's not different at all, and I think the most influential people for me in terms of the work I do in homeopathy have always been the biologists, and I guess in because of the time of the year that we're in with the Nobel Prize and stuff, I'd say one of the most influential people has been Conrad Lorenz, who got a Nobel Prize so many years ago.
Sure, I'm familiar with his work, yeah.
Yep.
A little bit would follow him, right?
So, well, the you know how you'd think when we talk about homeopathy and people, that it in a way, having a surgeon do homeopathy, there's something missing there. That's not where homeopathy is most elegant. That you almost need to blend or marry the hardest science of medicine with something like the softest humanities of psychology and anthropology and so on. In the same way, I guess the best word is ethology. You know, which is something that's not taught that much in veterinary schools, but it's the equivalent of what's missing in veterinary homeopathy at this moment. We have veterinarians and we have people that are not veterinarians that are treating animals and so on. But what we don't have is a sort of a blend between the hard science of veterinary medicine and ethology, and I believe that it's possible that this phone call is going to start the blend of that.
Hmm.
That, you know how, when they say success has a million fathers,
right.
This is going to be one of those.
Hmm.
But what's been missing is the, and I guess this is something that Lorenz started, just the concept of animal behavior.
Sure.
And that behavior can be understood even in a different species. And what's been at first funny to me and then puzzling and then just downright discouraging is just the amount of veterinarians that say the same thing of how you should not take the mental symptoms, and you shouldn't, because that's anthropomorphizing and so on. And while I understand the danger and I understand fully well the problem, because it's the same exact problem in treating people,
sure.
Reading into something that isn't really there, to not pay attention to an animal, to its behavior and to its emotions, it's in 2007, the only branch of veterinarians that do not pay attention to it are the homeopaths.
Interesting.
Which is really odd in a way. And you know, I have been at veterinary conferences, and I've been privy to meet veterinary homeopaths that are just, you know, incredibly smart people, very educated, very dedicated to their field, and watch an animal basically tear apart another animal or try to tear apart you, and at the same time think the animal needs silica or pulsatilla or something because that's a symptom in the ear. And that's what I mean. There's like sort of a cognitive dissonance because, you know, these people can quote Hahnemann left and right, but when it came right down to seeing the beauty of that whole animal, what was missing is a sort of a marriage of the veterinary school as it is today and ethology as it is today. And somewhere in between, there will be a future of that, but the very best prescribers in homeopathy will always be the ones that can marry those two. So for me, it's very similar to treat an animal, to teach somebody to treat an animal, to treat a baby, to teach somebody to treat a baby, to treat somebody in a different language or a different heritage, and so on. It's, you know, it's the same discussions I've always have, you know, going to a new culture and the people saying, well, you don't really understand Greek people, you don't really understand French people, you don't really understand Russian people. But, you know, the fact is, there are certain underlying principles that underlie our work that go beyond those things and actually allow you a much deeper understanding of what, and predictability of what happens to, or what can happen to your patients.
So, Paul, do you find that this is also true, like, for example, with regards to small animals versus large animals, that the treatment is fairly the same, or are there different considerations, or what's your experience in that realm?
It's very, very similar. Very, very similar. It's small. I guess the smallest I've worked with at this point is, and I don't really want to talk about this part so much, is for the last 6 months working with mice. And they are pretty little, you know, but working with rabbits or cats or dogs versus working with horses or working with wild animals versus working with...
So what about that? Are you finding any unusual things to consider when you work with wild versus domesticated animals?
There is a very interesting topic there, but it would take the rest of this discussion. Which is basically that the possible number of remedies that are available to treat a wild animal is much, much smaller than a domesticated animal.
That's interesting.
And that's you can work out the logic to that, but, you know, there'll be, if there are, let's say, 300 remedies, 400 remedies that I typically use in animal care, that number will be, you know, a fifth in wild animals.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. And there's a reason why, which, you know, there's so many things I'd like to talk about. It's almost like an hour, so like just not enough.
Sure. Well, we're going to book you up for the next 6 months, you know, 5 hours every week.
Can I, and a lot of this I wrote in the letters, but can I, you know, through the years, but I think so if you've got Lorenz there, probably the person that added the most to homeopathy that is unknown to homeopaths is a guy named Evelyn Hutchinson, who used to work at Yale. He was a biologist, zoologist, and he came up with the concept of a Hutchinsonian niche, which is if species are generally defined as in genetics, you know, they have these number of chromosomes and so on and so on and so on. They look like this and they have this color and so on. Hutchinson came up with a different concept. He said, why don't we forget about the organism itself and why don't we just pay attention to the niche it occupies? So it lives on this temperature to this temperature. It lives at this height to this height on the tree. It prefers to eat this thing. It eats at this time. It doesn't like this foods, but it eats these kinds of foods. Mm. What does that sound like?
Yeah. It's like homeopathy. It
sounds
sure.
like homeopathy. So it's basically the when a homeopath tries to meet a scientist, they usually are trying to talk on the genetic level. The scientist is talking on the genetic level. The homeopath is talking on the Hutchinsonian niche level, and they're having a problem in communication.
Mm, that's interesting,
but,
Paul.
But it's sort of not a blind spot. It's like a little bit of an unknown from both sides of them. But there's a way for homeopathy to actually be smack dab in the middle of all science. And it's unfortunate the way things are, but there's enough within science to show us, to give us the language for the work we do. Anyway, there's a lot there. The Hutchinsonian niche that we occupy, let's say a pulsatilla patient occupies, it can be a Russian pulsatilla person or a Czechoslovakian or a Kentucky pulsatilla person.
Or an elephant pulsatilla person?
Or elephant or a person or a man or a woman or a child. And to a certain extent, because of the time constraints, just sort of go with this for a little bit of a second, just for a second, to a certain extent, a person needing pulsatilla and a dog or an elephant needing pulsatilla have more in common than a person needing pulsatilla and a person needing tarantula, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's, I guess in some ways, not in all ways, obviously.
Well, not in all ways, but the way they lead their life,
sure,
to a certain extent, has similarities.
That pattern is the same, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's been a gas to watch that niche be filled by a man, a woman, a child of different cultures and then of different species.
Mm, very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, Paul, I know a lot of people have some trepidation about treating animals. You know, they just feel like it's different from treating humans and they don't know how to do it and haven't been trained. And I'm just curious, what do you feel yourself are the biggest challenge that people have working with animals?
Well, I mean, first of all, you should be a vet if you're going to be working with animals.
Mm.
You should have a license to see that animal, which I think is just pretty much the law. But if you have a vet, if you are a vet, if you are a homeopathic vet, the biggest trepidation is the same exact one as you have seeing patients that are people.
Mm.
You know, the there I am in the middle of a basketball game. My son is playing basketball and this guy is sitting next to me, and he says, "All right, let's go." And he's a vet, you know. So I'm like, "Where are we going?" He said, "I've got a patient. She's dying. She's got pneumonia, both lungs, and this and this and this. So why don't we see what homeopathy can do?" And this is somebody that I've known for years, and he just, you know, he kind of heard about homeopathy and kind of, you know, we socialize a fair amount. And so now that the animal's on her deathbed, why not give it a try? Which is not the best the best opportunity. So anyway, I walk in. I get the basic story of the dog had a kennel cough, then it sort of developed into, then it had pneumonia, then its knee was lame in one of its limbs. Anyway, long and short of it, perfect lycopodium. So I say, let's go lycopodium. And I'm away from my house, so it's inconvenient. But across the street is Whole Foods. So we end up at Whole Foods. The doors close. We knock really loudly, and the owner, the manager, opens up and says, you know, we're closed. And the guy says, I'm a vet from across the street. We need a remedy. Says, oh, no, we're totally closed. We just come back tomorrow. No, it's for a dog. It's going to die. And the manager's like, you should have said that in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
So they open up the door. We get lycopodium. We give lycopodium. And they only had like a 12C or something. So lycopodium at low potencies. And it's been, gosh, I want to say it's been like 2 years. And animal is doing great. Mm. It's doing great. The pneumonia just turned around, and you can see the x-rays just getting clearer and clearer, and she seems healthier than she had ever been, which has been a gas. So, like, in my mind, that story plays over and over. The guy sees it happen, you know? It's like his own personal experience. He knows this animal. He's been following this animal for X number of years. Then it's on its deathbed, and all of a sudden, is this miraculous turnaround. In his words, miraculous turnaround, incredible. Every time I see him, she's doing great, she's doing great. How come he doesn't practice homeopathy? You know, it's just, it's a very big question for me. No different than when we see a child that has horrific asthma or some sort of autoimmune disease or autism, and there's just straight out miracles. How come their pediatrician don't just turn it around?
Why do you think that is, Paul?
I think the worldview is different.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has their own personal worldview. Homeopaths have theirs. And you know, our medical colleagues have theirs. And sometimes people are just unchanged by experience.
Yeah.
I
totally hear what you're saying, because you think, like, if you find the truth, like, man, you just run with it, and, you know.
Right.
But I guess it's difficult to make such profound life changes, you know, for many people.
Right.
Yeah. So, Paul, when you're, you know, since getting back to the topic here, when you're working using homeopathy with animals versus people, what would you say are the similarities and what are the differences between using homeopathy with people versus animals?
If we can change, with people I can ask questions and get the answers.
Yeah.
So that's one difference. So then if we can subset the people into either people that are unconscious or children that are below communication age or children that don't speak, that, for instance, suffer from autism or babies or, a child that's in utero that's having trouble. Any of those situations, if we take those, there is no difference.
Hmm.
The only thing missing is the verbal. But you know, first weekend of any talk I give, I talk about how the verbal question and answer part is the least, you know, it's the crudest form of communication that we have.
Sure.
It's a very important one, but it's the crudest one. What's interesting about animals is because of the that thing that I am sort of skipping as to why wild animals need a smaller number. From my point of view, it's much easier to get the remedy picture of an animal because there's less confusion. There's just less. They are who they are. It's just a question of being able to perceive it. So in terms of similarities, it's very easy for us to get the temperament of the animal.
Mm.
And a lot of times what I'll do when we are treating an animal is I'll have the vets not ask any questions. Nobody talks. They just get to look at the animal and just get their perceptions. And at this point, you know, after a while, they can fill up a page or two of just pure perceptions of what they're seeing without getting to the chief complaint, without knowing what the problem is. And that's the same, you know, that's the same as we do with people. And then after that, we start asking questions of the owner, what the chief complaint is, and then slowly but surely we'll create a cycle that's made up of the segments that ails the animal. And when it's all said and done, we're able to predict the symptoms of the animal, which is sort of our confirmation. It's sort of a way to confirm that we're onto the real pathology of that needs to be fixed. For example, the a veratrum album horse or a stramonium horse or a Echiaricus horse is very, very similar to what those remedies look like in people.
Mm-hmm.
Same
complaint. It's interesting because one of the things that people are concerned about is this whole nonverbal arena that you have to contend with when you're taking the case of an animal. And yet it's interesting, what you're saying really is the opposite. It's that the fact that all that psychological compensation is out of the way, it actually makes it easier to perceive clearly what is the actual state of the patient.
And that goes both ways. That goes in terms of the patient themselves, their opinion of themselves in terms of how they put it into language, and then the homeopath's perceptions as well.
Right.
You can pretty much cut right through all of that and just see, and that's kind of the ethology of it, the just see the animal for what it is.
Sure, sure.
And based on its behaviors and based on the chief complaint and what makes it worse and better, and then the confirmation, which I think has been really a neat feature of the cycles and segments part, is that you can start cataloging all the symptoms of the animal, into all of them, you know, into its the different segments, and then be able to confirm the prescription. I'll give you an example. There's this, a couple of years ago, we saw a horse that was a weaver. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't know what that
is. It's weavers sort of move side to side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a
weave.
Ball cracker. Yeah, they weave back and forth when they're standing still. Kind of like they think it might be like a trigeminal neuralgia. It's mm-hmm. neurologic in nature. Anyway, I take the case. And basically, I come down to Agaricus. And so, you know, I ask the owner, you know, if this is Agaricus, basically, I say, it must sort of give up power at some point. It must sort of submit. Is it like a leader in the group? Is it sort of like a follower in the group? Is it like, you know, at what point does it give up its power to? You know, without getting into a long discussion of Agaricus, it's a very big piece of the remedy that happens in every single Agaricus patient, each and every time. And so we're kind of going through it, and she says, well, you know, when the horse is in the midst of this weaving thing, the only thing that calms it down is if he'll go up to a tree stump or a pole and just get like really close to it and just sort of meditate on it, just sort of stare at it. It was like so perfect. It was so perfect for Agaricus, and Agaricus made that whole thing go away. Or a silica patient, a silica horse, or just all kinds of stories. Tons of stories. But they all come down to the same thing: the behavior that we see in the animal matches perfectly a similar behavior in people, and the complaint, the physical complaint, matches perfectly the physical complaints in people. And then what's really interesting from the segment point of view is matching the behaviors to the physical complaint. And that's the part that has always been missing in homeopathy. That's where people anthropomorphize animals or where people read into cases with people incorrectly. So we're able to get rid of what I consider as one of the biggest problems in homeopathy, in that we actually created a profession that is actually, I mean, you have to use holism as a, it actually looks at the whole animal, or at the whole person, at the whole patient at once. You know, because there's that whole dichotomy in the Organon where every aphorism talks about treating the whole to one extent or another, and then you get to 153, and all of a sudden, are you treating the whole? Are you treating 153? Just the part, and then there's the sort of dialectic that plays out. But there's actually a way to marry those two, and that I think is what has been quite useful for people that have done this with veterinary work and with pediatricians and with, you know, children suffering from autism and with pregnant women and so forth.
Interesting. And it really demonstrates the universal application of the work that you're doing, which is really, you know, I think fascinating. Paul, have you seen any exceptions at all in terms of various species of animals, in terms of certain qualities or remedy states, or have you just found that
you know? No, it's you know, there is a way to look at homeopathy as a universal special application of universal truth. Mm-hmm. So given that, there just really aren't any exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the sloppiness that happens in me not being able to see it as clearly, or somebody else not being able to see it as clearly on the first time or the second time. But that's the practice part. That's the trying to see it better and better. But, you know, is a dog different than a horse? Is a mouse different than a goat or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the same question as, are animals different than people?
Right.
Or are children different than people, you know, than adults? They play out differently. A symptom might be slightly changed, but it fits perfectly within that segment.
Very interesting. Paul, you know, I've had a lot of interaction with the homeopathic community here in the United States and Canada, and I've always been very impressed with their level of professionalism, especially when you compare them with other members of the homeopathic community working with focusing on the treatment of humans. And I was just curious, I know this group is really striving to promote homeopathy, veterinarian homeopathy, and do you have any suggestions or thoughts on how they could interact with the traditional veterinary community, or any ideas on what they could do to promote the good work of homeopathy?
Well, I guess, first of all, we should just mention that the group you're probably referring to is the Academy of Veterinary Homeopaths.
Yeah, yeah.
The AVH, and I think they do have a website, so I just walked in, so I don't have it. But if you Google Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy, that should get you up to, you know, how to join them or how to find a vet near you and so on. They are running into the same exact problem that plagues homeopathy around the world, which is a somewhat isolated community originally. And as it's sort of branching out and joining the larger homeopathic community, they're going to start getting bombarded with this kind of homeopathy and that kind of homeopathy, and they're going to run into basically the same issues that the rest of the homeopathic community is contending with.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one thing I would say, is somehow figure out how to branch ethology with veterinary homeopathy.
Mm.
And you know, from my point of view, I've always felt that they are one of the kind of potential saving graces in homeopathy because they can help the rest of us prove principles that we can't do otherwise, because we can basically remove the placebo effect question.
Sure.
It's to a certain extent, it's a youngish profession in the homeopathic world. I mean, you know, I know that veterinary homeopathy has been around for many, many generations. I've met great homeopaths that were veterinarians, but to a certain extent, they are similar to a country where a certain kind of homeopathy was practiced for 100 years and unchanged, and then just now all the doors are opening and tons of change is happening, and I worry for their future in terms of that. I think what winds up happening often is there's this sort of consolidated group, and then it starts breaking apart into this camp and this camp and this camp.
We're running a little bit close on opening it up for questions from the participants, but I thought perhaps I could ask you one more question before I open up the lines.
Yep.
Paul, any other interesting stories you want to share with us about your use of homeopathy in treating animals, or any words of encouragement that you'd like to give on the subject?
Well, you know, I've seen seizures go away. I've seen all kinds of neurologic things go away. I've seen horrific infections be stopped. I've seen, you know, what vets have an opportunity to do that no other profession in the Western world has is, to a certain extent, it's a kind of a general practice large, in that in most of our experiences, if we see somebody that has, you know, terrible sort of cancer, or terrible this complaint or that complaint, you pretty much lose them at that point to specialists.
Right.
So the general practitioner rarely gets a chance to work with these people. That's what they do. They see everybody from, you know, brand new kittens to, you know, 15, 18-year-olds that are, you know, on their deathbed with tumors everywhere and so on. So they have a sort of an opportunity to do something that the rest of the homeopathic community can't, which is to gather a lot of information on sort of, I hate the term, kind of end-stage pathology. A lot of times you get patients that, let's say animals, and the owner just wants to euthanize them, period. Or they can't afford treatment, or somehow life at times is cheaper for them than for people. And, you know, I encourage any of the homeopathic vets to sort of adopt that animal, take care of it. And I think that is a useful thing for the rest of the homeopathic community to say, I have treated 300 seizure patients, I have treated 2,000 seizure patients without seizure meds. You know, you just can't do that with people. So I hope that sort of thing can come to the homeopathic community through the vets.
Very interesting. Well, it was a very enlightening discussion, Paul. Before I open up the line to the participants, let me just give out your website information again. It's www.nesh, which is N as in Nancy, E, S as in Sam, H as in Harry.com. So www.nesh.com. And on that website, you can get information about seminars that Dr. Herskew is offering, and also with his wife, Amy Rothenberg. And Paul, the seminar in Portland is starting, what's the date for that?
That's starting in January.
January. And the best place to get information on that is at the NESH website, is that correct?
Yep.
And what about the Herskew letter?
You should just give two other websites. One is the Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy.
Okay.
Which is, I don't know the website, but they can look that up.
Yeah, they can Google that. That's for the AVH.
Yep. And the other one is the place that I teach through, which is run by Peggy Fleming, not the skater.
Skater,
the vet. And I know her phone number is 352-583-2400. She is just the greatest person in terms of animals. She will just bat for the animal like 110%, and she's, you know, homeopathy, acupuncture, body work, just everything.
Great.
That's been really a great homeopath. So between those two sort of website things in terms of vets, people should be able to get their needs met in terms of animals.
And Paul, the Hirsky letter that you put out, could you just give us a quick synopsis of that and where people could get more information about it?
Oh, that's something I write every 2 weeks or so, twice a month, and you can get that from the same thing, NESH.com. So, you know, back to the animals. Like, some of the most interesting things, the sort of theoretical stuff, just trying to understand why it works a certain way and why a lot of questions just disappear. It's too short of a time. Some of that stuff I wrote in the letter, but it is, I just want to just highlight the fact that treating animals has exactly the same rules, as treating humans.
Great. All right, Paul, let me go ahead and open up the lines and let some other people ask you some questions. Hold on 1 second.
Do you not like the term end-stage pathology?
Well, it just sounds like they're just going to die. And honestly, we're all going to die at some point. But a lot of, quote, end-stage pathology, you sometimes see the people living for another 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years, and sometimes you see the same thing with animals, that, you know, they're on their deathbed and then they're not, you know, and so is it really end stage? You know, sometimes it is, we still can't totally predict when somebody's going to make that sort of turnaround, so I hate to be pessimistic like that.
Okay, we hear you. All right, other questions for Dr. Hirsky?
Dr. Jordan here. I just wanted to let them know that the website for the Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy is www.theavh.org.
Thank you very much for
that. Thank you. Like the AVH.
Right.
Great. Thank you. And I think pretty much anything you want on veterinary. I don't know if it's international or just American or Canadian, but
no,
it's a good place to start.
Yeah, they're encouraging members from all over the world, and
right.
They pretty much are practicing classic homeopathy, so I was a little confused about what you were saying, that they may be getting problems with these others.
That term is used so loosely in that, you know, I taught a course, I taught a short discussion at a group. I went out for lunch and so on afterwards, and the person I was having lunch with is a classical homeopath, understands classical everything and just Hahnemann up and down and all this stuff, and said, "Well, can you help me with an animal?" So, well, what's wrong with the animal? She said, "Well, it's an ear problem." You know, right there, that is so unhomeopathic. It is so unhomeopathic. And then as we went through the case, what was missing in the case was the animal. So I understand when people say homeopathic, that classical, I understand what they generally mean by that, which is that they've read the Organon and can repeat the Organon and have the good desire to do good work. But what I've seen from the difference between what can be done and what is done is it's very much a there's a sort of a dichotomy there. There's a sort of a split.
They list the standards of practice and what that means to be practicing homeopathy as an American, of the Academy of Veterinary Homeopaths, called the Standards of Practice and the Purpose of the Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy.
I'm sorry, we missed the first part of what you were saying. Can you repeat it again for us?
The standards of practice?
Yeah, you were just mentioning that for everybody to know about, or?
Yes, because that is how we define the type of homeopathy that we practice.
I see, okay.
You have to actually agree to be within the
difference between.
Thank you for that information. Other questions for Dr. Herskew?
Yes, may I ask a question?
Please.
My name is Marlene. I'm a wildlife rehabilitator in New Hampshire.
Oh, excellent.
And
my favorite people.
New Hampshire people or wildlife
rehabilitators. I've worked with them a lot. I love them. I, in my next life, I hope to be one.
or marry one at the very least.
But I'd like to have you come on board right now. I'd like to know where to find more information about, you were saying there were fewer remedies available or possible for wildlife versus domestic.
I can answer that in a, yes, the answer is yes. There's a reason why I don't think I have enough. Does this call end exactly at 9?
Oh, no, but when you were saying that, I thought you were going to say, I can name that remedy in 3 notes.
does this end exactly at 9?
Why don't you just talk, Paul, and if we get cut off, we get cut off.
Okay, I guess I'm just going to answer that question for the remainder of it. There's a thing in developmental biology called evolutionary runaway development. This is like the bird that has the huge tail, the beak that's incredibly long, the multicolored, really incredibly bright colored, this and that. Okay? So that thing is another term for it is excessive display. And what's interesting about that is there's been like a long discussion on this as to why something like that develops. And the closest thing that they could figure is just biological advantage of strength of strength of individual, in that it's usually males that have that in just about all the species, and the strength of it is to say, here I am, bright red color, come and mate with me, or come and eat me as food. So if that particular individual was strong enough to survive to mating thing, it mates, but it shows a sort of fitness. So that sort of fitness, which is on the one hand strong enough to get food and not be eaten, strong enough to show yourself to predators and not be eaten, strong enough to show yourself to individual females and not be eaten, that thing is, to be that strong, you have to capture something called to be within the fitness landscape strong enough to be able to survive. Those that aren't just get eaten early on. As a result, that's an incredibly short version of a long discussion, but the bottom line is you just are down to a short number of remedies. Most remedies don't get a chance to get expressed large enough, long enough in nature, because as the individual is starting to express itself in this odd way or that odd way, they start to stand outside the group to get eaten. As a result, there's just a much smaller number.
Very interesting, Paul.
It goes on and on.
I see where you're getting at with it. It's very interesting.
And then it has specific, that concept then has specific consequences to the classical homeopath treating people. Because you know, in nature, there's just a lot of what we consider odd behavior, or let's say odd behavior, just wouldn't really exist in nature, because you just wouldn't develop that you couldn't exist. And this, which is why an adult human being might need one of 4,000 remedies, but a child human being cannot need one of 5,000 remedies. They can only need one of 200 remedies.
Right.
Which has to do with just the longer you go, the more exuberant your behavior can get.
Interesting.
Anyway, in domesticated animals, it's much easier to get away with stuff because you're not going to get eaten. In wild, that just doesn't happen.
Right.
So it's a much smaller group. Right. Part of a large discussion, but anyway, which fits very nicely. It puts homeopathy and the experiences we have smack dab in the middle of natural sciences. It's just something for years from now.
Well, Paul, this was a great, very enlightening discussion. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm going to unmute the lines and let everyone personally thank you. I want to thank you again. I know you're very busy, and it's always greatly appreciated if you take your time out and join us like this and share all your knowledge and information. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. It seems like Arsenicum is winding up to be a genus epidemicus just now, and good luck treating animals. Good luck converting your vets to homeopathy. Good luck converting your homeopaths to classical homeopathy. Good luck converting your classical homeopathic vets to a fuller understanding of where veterinary medicine fits within the larger scope of life.
Sounds great. Hold on a second, Paul. Can we give Paul a big thank you?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.